Okay, now it's
doing what it is supposed to do.
All right, so these copies of Ri are conjugate to each other under L, under this larger group L, and therefore they are basically the same group. Okay, so and what I can do is I can look at a particular group in the full symmetric group. Group we can consider, let, and I call this K, be R1 cross and so forth cross Rn. So I'm taking the direct product of all of these copies. Okay. So everything is living in this bigger symmetric group. H, so far I've taken the projections of the point stabilizer on each copy. The point stabilizer could be a subdirect product of these projections. And indeed, we will have in some cases that it is. But a subdirect product always lies in a direct product. So I can always form these projections. I can take them and I can take their direct product. And clearly, that will contain the point stabilizer H omega. So this group K is not necessarily in G. We don't know about this here. So we have this group K sitting somewhere. Well, is it clearly contained? Is it obvious that it is contained in L? Not necessarily, yes, yet, but basically we'll get to this situation. Okay. So, what I'm now going to do is I will do a case distinction, namely, this Ri can't be trivial. Because if it was trivial, all projections of the point stabilizer would be trivial. Then the point stabilizer itself would be trivial, the action is regular. Right? So because it's not regular, that implies that the Ri can't be the trivial group. So what they can be is they can be therefore a proper subgroup or the full group. And I will do a case distinction. So case one is that Ri is a proper subgroup of Ti. It's not the whole group. Okay. Right. So now he claims. Sorry. K, of course. K is the. Sorry. H was the direct product of the T's. K is the direct product of subgroups of T, so I know K certainly must lie here, right? So K and this clearly must lie in H, and there is nothing miraculous to be done that follows just because I'm taking subgroups of the T's. So that's where K lies. So what I have is I have H omega lies in K, and that is strictly smaller than H. And it's strictly smaller because I'm not projecting fully on the components. Right? Okay. So, the next thing I want to see is that K is actually equal to the point stabilizer. So now I want to show that K is equal to the point stabilizer H omega. Okay. Right. If K was strictly larger than the point stabilizer, so if K was strictly larger than the point stabilizer, K would contain points which don't stabilize the point omega, right? So this means that if I take K and the point stabilizer L omega, or let's take the group generated by both. This group would be strictly larger than L omega, right? Because L omega just are elements which stabilize the point, and K contains an element which does not stabilize the point. Okay, it would be strictly larger, but G was primitive, and therefore L is primitive, right? But this point stabilizer is a maximal subgroup of L, and that's because L is primitive. Well, if I have a maximal subgroup and I add something to it, that means that must be the whole group, right? That would have to be the whole group. Okay. Yeah?
Sorry, this is perhaps stupid, but we can't be in the situation where the things in K that don't stabilize omega are in sort of L omega minus H omega?
Well, what would these elements do then if they were in L omega? If they add these extra elements were in L omega, they would fix the point omega. And they are in H by basically by construction, right? That's why this can't happen.
Great.
Okay. So that's why it has to be strictly larger. And then the primitivity, which, I mean, we need to use it at some point. If we don't assume that we will, if you don't assume all the prerequisites of a theorem in the proof, your proof must be wrong, or you will never get to prove it, because the statement in general is not true.
Or you can throw out a hypothesis.
Yes.
In which case you're really happy.
Yeah. Okay. Right. So these generate this. Okay. What I now claim is that K is normalized by L omega. Okay. Why is this the case? Well, K was the direct product of these copies here, right? What can L do with the different copies of T and H? L will permute these copies. Okay. So it will map T1 to T2 and so forth. Well, if I'm in L omega, I'm stabilizing the point omega. So anything I can do for each projection is that my image is just RI, right? I'm not in TI anymore, I'm just in RI if I'm in L omega. Well, but then what can L omega do with the RIs? L omega can just map, they're actually not just conjugate under L, they're conjugate under L omega. L omega will copy one of the copies of RI to one of the other copies of RI. Right? because it must stabilize the point and it must permute the components. That's all it can do. And since I've taken the direct product here, since I haven't taken H omega, but I've explicitly taken the direct product, the copies are permuted, and that keeps their direct product fixed. So, K is normalized by L omega, since L omega permutes the Ri. It cannot map one of the Ri's to something else. Because L must map, if I'm, let's say I'm R1, then I'm a subgroup of T1. I'm conjugating with L, so if I have a subgroup of T1, I will get a subgroup of one of the other T's, because L permutes them. And if I have a point stabilizer initially, I'm mapping to the corresponding subgroup of the other copy of T, and that's the point stabilizer there. And that is exactly what we call the Ri. So, L omega permutes the Ri, so K is normalized by L omega. Well, this implies that because K is normalized by L omega, K is normalized by K, K is normalized by L omega, that would mean K is normalized, or therefore is normal in L. Okay. But, and this was basically, that would contradict that H, that would mean H is not minimally normal. H is not minimally normal in L. But the reason we had created L was exactly to make H minimally normal. We wanted to avoid that case of two normal subgroups. So that cannot happen. So K has to be H omega. So the points there, so what we have seen is, if we have a primitive group with not regular socle, we are taking the point stabilizer and we're looking at how does the point stabilizer project on its different components. Then the point stabilizer, if it doesn't project on the whole group, the point stabilizer is just a direct product. So what we have seen, so this was showing that this holds, so we can conclude that is H, and now we can forget the definition of K because it's the same as H omega. H omega is just R, the direct product, R1 cross Rn. Okay. So, what I have done is I have my group H, which is a direct product of copies of the group T. I have taken subgroups of T, and I'm taking basically the same subgroup in each copy, right? They're permuted amongst each other. I'm taking particular subgroup there, and I'm taking the direct product of these subgroups. And that is the point stabilizer in the socle. Well, that is exactly the situation we had in the case of the product action, right? The point stabilizer of the socle, in the product action, is a direct product of point stabilizers. So, this arrow, let me put it in inverted commas, because there is a little bit one would have to show. Basically, what you need to show is that if you have such a subgroup, that the normalizer of this subgroup is the Riesz product in product action. So the normalizer, what goes in here, the normalizer in the symmetric group of R1 cross and so forth, Rn, is the Riesz product T Riesz Sn in product action. And if I talk about a Riesz product in product action, the first group must be a permutation group. So this would be the action of T on the cosets of R. Right, because otherwise that doesn't become the point stabilizer, and that is then certainly a permutation question. Right. So I have. So then, So the normalizer is the wreath thrower in production. That means G is contained in the wreath product in product action. And that basically will be what I will call case 3 of the Onen-Scott theorem. I will call it case 4. I will not yet write that case 4 down because we will get a little bit a case distinction. Okay, so we have it in a product action, and what can I tell about the action of the first factor? Where T acts primitively. So, what I had seen is I can take a simple group or an almost simple group and can have it act primitively. And I could allow the automorphism group of T here. That could be slightly where ought T. I could, for example, instead of A5, I could have S. I mean, I can form the group S5 wreath product C2 in product action, and that is a primitive group. And that would be exactly of this case. So, where ought T acts primitively, and the point stabilizer in T of some point is this subgroup R. Sorry, I need to allow that. So, we had the situation of almost simple groups, right? That would be odd T. And we can look at, we have primitive groups which are almost simple, and there we can't basically reduce further. So we have a primitive action of odd T, or a subgroup of odd T. And that is a primitive group, and if I form the wreath product in product action, we have seen if we take a primitive group as the first factor, if we take a wreath product in product action under certain conditions, the result will again be primitive. Well, this action clearly is not regular. Otherwise, it's not primitive. So that class must exist. And we have basically seen not only does the class exist, wreath products in product action, where my first factor is all primitive of almost simple type, but we have seen in which situation this happens. This happens if the point stabilizer in the socle doesn't project on the whole copy. And then I'm in that situation. Okay. So. And I will write down later this case as case of the Onen-Scott theorem. The reason why I don't yet write it down is there is one other thing which can happen. Okay. So. The other thing which can happen is Yeah, it's basically the case that my subgroup here does actually that the image of that Ri is the same as Ti. Okay? So case two.
So I should say, so this will go to Owen and Scott class 4, and I think I'm calling it for A. No, I'm calling it for C. Okay. And basically for A and for B are with products and product action of slightly different kind. That's why there is a C. Okay. So let's go to case two. Case two would be that Ri is equal to Ti. So the point stabilizer in omega, the point stabilizer in H projects on each component of H, on each copy of T as the full T. So, well, it can't be the full T. Then the point stabilizer clearly can't be such a direct product, because the direct product is the whole of H. So the point stabilizer is a proper subdirect product. Right? It's a subgroup which projects on copies but is smaller than the direct, strictly smaller than the direct product of these copies. Okay. And what I need to do in this case, and now again I'm going to skip over some of the technical details. Because what I can now do is I will look at how are these copies actually hanging together in the form of a subdirect product. So now consider how these copies are, well, I tend to call it glued together, even though that is not, that is not really the proper language for describing, right? How, what I, for describing subdirect products, I need to describe isomorphisms among factor groups. So what factor groups are there and what isomorphisms do I have? Okay. Right, and to see how they are hanging together, what did we need to do when looking at a subdirect product? How did we get these components? Basically, we looked at the kernel of when projecting on one component and looked at how does this kernel project onto other components? That was the fundamental ingredient. So that's what I'm doing now. So I want to see what is the kernel, and I will call this Ki, which is the kernel when projecting on a component. And I want to see not only what is this, what actually are these kernels, but I want to see, so in this case, well, K, so the notation might be slightly misleading. K, okay, Ki, Ki still lies, K lies in H all the time. Ki, if I take the kernel of the projection that does not necessarily lie in K. Right? That Ka is a subgroup of H, but does not. K was this direct product. There is initially not a reason that it should be. And I want to take Ki, the kernel of the projection pi I, intersected with a point stabilizer. So what I want to do is I'm looking at the elements in the point stabilizer which are projecting trivially on one of the copies. Okay. And so the first situation I can have is in that subcase they call Dixon and Mortimer call this subcase 2 prime, is that Ki is the trivial group. So H omega projects, H omega projects on each copy of T on surjectively. But if I stabilize one point in there, everything becomes trivial. So that means in particular that the order of H alpha is the same as the order of T. And H alpha must be a subdirect product where everything is glued together maximally. Right? So H omega must be isomorphic to T. Why is this the case? Well, I know that H omega projects onto, let's say, T1. That was case two. H omega projects onto T1. If I stabilize one, okay, if I take the kernel of that projection, that is this Ki. The kernel of the projection is trivial, so I know H omega is isomorphic to T. And what does it mean that actually what it is as a group? It is what is called a diagonal subgroup. So it must be a group of the form where I have elements T, T, and I don't have T1, T2. I always have the same element for T in T. Right? I'm taking the set, and okay, here I'm identifying them. If you want to analyze this in a case, you would actually need to construct isomorphisms between the copies. And that is called a diagonal subgroup. And diagonal for the pretty obvious reason that if you look at this subset, at this set as a subset of a Cartesian product, it is exactly the diagonal, right? So is a diagonal subgroup. Okay. So let's look at these diagonal groups. Can I make these primitive groups? So let me first look at what would this mean? Let's say we go in for the case that the bisocle is A5 cross A5, right? That is a group of order 60 times 60, which is 3,600. So the point stabilizer would be isomorphic to A5, would have only order 60. So I have an action of degrees 60. Or if I take three copies of A5, I would have a subgroup of order 60 in a group of order 60 cubed. So my index would be 3,600. Right? And These action, yeah, and this is called a diagonal action. So, definition. So let T be a simple group. And I'm taking n copies of T, so n is, well, let's say it's greater or equal than 2. The diagonal action of T cross T is the action on the cosets of the diagonal of a diagonal subgroup which would consist of elements of the form T cross T cross T. I mean T always the same element T in each of the components. That's what we call the diagonal action. Okay.
So just for question, I was just thinking back to this H. So could it be that one of the T's is just like a T inverse or something like that? Like instead of that they're strictly that way, or is that like, or is it like up to isomorphism? It doesn't really matter.
It's basically up to isomorphism. That's where I said, where I was slightly waffling and said, oh, I'm writing all this T. I really would need to describe what isomorphisms I'm choosing between the components. And what I'm doing here is implicitly that I'm saying, oh, I'm acting transitively and they are conjugate and that gives me the isomorphisms. Okay. But actually it doesn't give you the isomorphisms completely concretely. It gives you the isomorphisms in certain cases or up to certain, for example, up to inner isomorphisms. Or even actually up to inner automorphisms and automorphisms induced in certain cases. So you will have, in general, many diagonal subgroups. Okay, and many of them will be conjugate. So, for example, if I take the case of A5, and let me write A5 as an intransitive group. So I'm going, this belongs here, this as an example. So I have A5 cross A5 as a subgroup of S10. Right? So to construct a diagonal group, I could, for example, say I'm taking, okay, and one can show A5 is generated by the 3 cycle 1, 2, 3 and the 3 cycle 3, 4, 5. That's a little bit to show, it's not hard, but so I could take 1, 2, 3. Okay, and then because I want it to be diagonal, so this A5 acts on the points 1, 2, 5, this A5 acts on the points 6 to 10, right? So I'm taking the element 1, 2, 3 and I'm taking the element 6, 7, 8 and I'm taking the element 3, 4, 5 together with 8, 9, 10. Right? That would be such a diagonal subgroup. Okay, you can take another one. You could, for example, say you take 1, 2, 3, and now you apply an automorphism of A5. For example, let's say I relay the automorphism there is, come. Let's take one which takes, well, actually all of them come from S5, but we don't need to know this. Let's take one which comes from S5, namely one which just renumbers the points from 10, 9 up to 6, right? So I could take this together with 10, 9, 8 and 3, 4, 5 would be coupled with 8, 7, 6.
And that is also a diagonal subgroup. And it's a perfectly good diagonal subgroup. However, these two diagonal subgroups are conjugate in A5 cross A5. Or sorry, are they? No, not, oh, no, I can't yet say. But they are conjugate in S5 cross S5. Because if I allow myself to apply an S5 conjugation on the remaining, on the points 6 to 10, I can map this to this while keeping the first one fixed. So, they will be two-point stabilizers, but actually, and now it would depend, in this case, actually, the map which maps the points in this way is an element in A5, because I swap 10 and 6, 9 and 7, I keep 8 fixed, right? So I have 4 pair switches, which is an even number. So actually, it's an even permutation. So these are not just conjugate in S5 cross S5, but they're conjugate in A5 cross A5. So they are conjugate point stabilizers. That means they're just point stabilizers for a different point in the same orbit. And therefore, in some way, they don't give me anything new. But if they were conjugate under automorphisms, which are not realized in this group G, they would give me another diagonal subgroup, which in some way looks exactly the same, and where the action might look rather similar, but which is not conjugate. So at that point, you would get to the question where you have, when looking at this, the question you would need to answer is, if you don't want to classify, how do primitive groups look like? So in the Onan Scott theorem, I'm saying, I want to describe how does a primitive group look like. And I'm saying, okay, the point stabilizer has this form, and here implicitly I've chosen an isomorphism, which comes from here, from some choice choosing conjugate elements. And I'm just saying they are the same. If instead I'm asking I want to classify maximal subgroups up to conjugacy, I need to deal exactly with these possible, I need to see, okay, there are tons of diagonal subgroups, which of them are conjugate and which of them are not conjugate. And that will give me sometimes a group can be in this diagonal action of the same degree, and this gives me two different not conjugate maximal subgroups. Okay, but that was in some way going into more difficulty than I wanted to explain. But yeah, I mean, you're completely right. There is some very non-trivial subtlety which I had tried to sweep under the carpet.
Sorry to foil your
mind. No. It's a very good question, and it's something where I looked at in for the dual case, basically trying to classify, to describe an algorithm to find maximal subgroups, and that needs to deal exactly with this case. Okay. Right. So, if we have this group, that gives me a diagonal subgroup, and again, I will have many more by just choosing different isomorphisms. So in some way, I've once implicitly chosen, or by writing it T cross T, then by the isomorphism I've chosen is the identity. If you come with a concrete group, you must first choose the isomorphism. Okay, so this is the action, is the diagonal action of T. Okay, so if I take this action, I get a permutation action, I get a homomorphism into a symmetric group. It's easy to see that homomorphism is faithful, because if you take the conjugates of this diagonal group, then you can change, for example, with an inner automorphism in the second component by keeping the first component the same, and they intersect trivially. So clearly this is a faithful action. Okay, so I can look at these groups as subgroups of the symmetric group. So now
let T cross T, and I will call it H because it will be the circle of a resulting group, be a subgroup of the symmetric group. Okay, and now what would be the degree? The degree would be the order of T to the n minus 1. Right? I have n copies, and the point stabilizer has order n. No, sorry, the point stabilizer has order of T, so I have not order of T to the n, but order of T to the n minus 1. Right? In diagonal action. Okay. If I'm doing this, it's a subgroup, I can ask for what is the normalizer. Then the normalizer in this symmetric group of this group H. What is this? What can happen? So clearly I can get the group itself. I can get the T to the N, I can get the group normalizes itself. That I get for free. Right? Okay, what else can I do? What else can I do? I can...
How many copies of T are...
I have... N, sorry. That was the whole point. And it's just since I wrote N minus 1 here. Yeah, I want N copies of T. Yeah.
Great.
So, I have H itself.
Yeah.
What else can I do to normalize it? Okay. So, and what this dot basically means is just... I have a group where I'm describing the normal subgroup and I'm describing the factor group. But I'm not saying something about being a semi-direct product or so. Or I can write it actually, I can first take a thing where I can form a semi-direct product. Namely, in this diagonal group, I can clearly permute my components. Right? That will be compatible with this permutation action, because it actually will keep my diagonal subgroup just fixed. Right? So, I can take a wreath product with a group Sn, and I would also have Sn here, which is permuting the components. Okay, I can do this. What else can I do? Well, I know H has the structure T cross T cross T cross T. The normalizer must induce automorphisms. And since this action is faithful, actually, I can also consider the normalizer as a subgroup of the automorphism group. So I cannot do more than odd T wreath Sn, and that Sn is the same as this Sn, right? So clearly, this must lie in odd T wreath Sn, and that is because of the automorphism group structure. The normalizer cannot do more than what this would do. And this is, or at least from the, this is again up to isomorphism, because that actually isn't realizable in this symmetric group necessarily fully. Okay, but I must lie in this structure. I can't do more, because then I would have illegal automorphisms. Okay, so I just need to... So how do these two groups differ? This group differs in that I have the outer automorphisms on each copy, right? Which I have n times here. Well, if I do an outer automorphism on the second component, say, and that goes in some way back to your question, then I get another subgroup which is not conjugate, because it's an outer automorphism. I can't, and that means that is not compatible with preserving the permutation action. So I cannot do outer automorphisms on an individual component. The only thing I can do is I can do outer automorphisms on all the components simultaneously. That will fix this group. right? If I apply a certain outer automorphism, then I take t to the alpha, t to the alpha, t to the alpha, and so forth. That is the same group. I'm just writing down the elements in a different order. That is clearly fine. So I can only do outer automorphisms of t. I don't have n copies of outer automorphisms. I just have one copy, which does it all the same on all components.
And
this is out t with an o, because these are the outer automorphisms. So, I might not have defined. So this is out t is the automorphism group of t modulo the inner automorphisms of t. And because t is simple, the inner automorphisms actually are the same as t. So the outer automorphisms of A5 are cyclic of order 2. The outer automorphisms of A6 are C2 cross C2, and that's the complicated case. The outer automorphisms, if you take SL or PSL, what you get is you get conjugation with the matrices which have determinant not 1. And these are, in that case, also called diagonal, for different reason, diagonal automorphisms. You get transpose inverse if your degree is bigger than 2. In degree 2, that can be realized differently. But you're probably believing me that transpose inverse is an automorphism on matrix groups. And it keeps the determinant fixed. So it's an automorphism of SL. And that is called the graph automorphism, and again for reasons which have to do with things which are called Dynkin diagrams, which we haven't looked at, and you get possibly Galois automorphisms. If your group is defined over a field which is not a prime field, you can apply Galois automorphisms. This has nothing to do here, but it might be a useful. So, for example, the outer automorphisms of A5 are isomorphic to C2. The outer automorphisms, let's say, of SL3 over the field with 25 elements. All right, well, let's make it 125 elements, just to have not the same number there. So, if I look at this group, this consists of something which is conjugation by matrices of determinant not equal to 1, and that is basically isomorphic to GL modulo GL modulo SL. And we had looked at this before. There, we need to take the GCD of Q minus 1 with, 125 doesn't work, doesn't actually give me, let's keep it at 25, because then I have a non-trivial GCD, right? That has order GCD of N with Q minus 1. So I would have a 3 here. Okay, then I get, and it turns out that it's actually a semi-direct probe, but then that is not completely trivial to show, with Galois automorphisms. So in this case, the Galois automorphisms would be the Galois group of GF25 over GF5, so that's degree 2, so that's isomorphic to C2. And I get something which has order 2, and that's transpose inverse. And that is called, for at this point rather obscure reasons, the graph automorphism. And that is a statement which actually generalizes to other groups. I mean, that holds. This is something which holds for basically all the SLs. The only thing where you have to be careful in dimension two, this is not something new. This is something which you can get in weird ways from the rest. This also generalizes to other classical groups. If you don't take the full linear group, but you take the symplectic group or the unitary group, groups which preserve certain inner product structures, or more generally what are called the groups of Lie type, you always have this outer automorphism structure. You have something, and these are called for no reason to do with the diagonal construction. That is really just, these are called the diagonal. But that diagonal has nothing to do with this diagonal, apart from the fact that it's the same word. You get something, automorphisms which come from the larger group if you allow determinant not being equal to one. You get the Galois automorphism. And in some cases, you get something. It's not always transpose inverse. In some cases, you can get such a graph automorphism. In some cases, you can't. But that is the structure for all groups of Lie type, which is the vast majority of simple groups of the outer automorphism. But and that this holds is a consequence of the classification of this finite simple groups. So that is a rather deep result. But you might, if you ever work with some of these groups, someone might come with such a statement. And the reason I mentioned this here is basically just so you've seen it once before. Okay. Right.
So just a quick question. You say it was the Galois group. If we're talking about these automorphisms, yeah. So you usually think about Galois groups as permeating the roots, right?
No.
Where are you? Is there the field?
No, there is just a field. Now, when I looked as Galois groups as permutation groups, I'm looking at them permuting the roots.
Okay.
Here, I'm looking at the Galois. Here, I have a matrix group over a field.
Okay.
And this field is a field extension. Okay. So, if this was SL35, I would not get this. If I would have SL325, this would become trivial because 3 and 124. Don't have a common GCD. So I would need to take, if I take 625, no, that still doesn't work, so I would need to take one more, 5 times 625, to get again something happening, or I probably should have chosen a different prime. Okay, but that's just... That's what outer automorphism, some examples of what outer automorphisms are. So, if I take such a direct product of simple groups in diagonal action, what the normalizer can do at most is it can permute the components, it can do a simultaneous outer automorphism on all the copies. Okay. And I can't do different outer automorphisms on different copies, what the full automorphism group would give me. So this is strictly smaller. Okay? Right. So that's how a group can look in diagonal action. And what I have seen is, if I start with a primitive group where the point stabilizer projects onto each component fully as the full simple group. The point stabilizer in the socle projects fully on each copy of T in the socle. Then my group is, the socle is in diagonal action. The socle is normal, so it's normalized by G, so G must lie in the normalizer of the socle. So G must be a subgroup of this type. Okay, and that's class 3 of the Olenskog theorem. And this I can now write down. And I know this gets, I mean, what might be slightly unsatisfactory, some of the cases of the constructions, they get a little bit fiddly, and I'm definitely not giving you the full proof.
What I want to do is basically just that you understand what these classes are and get a bit an idea why these classes must come up. Why it's at least plausible that you don't get more. So, I had warned you when I wrote down the Onan-Scott theorem that you should keep some space free if you want to have consistent nodes. So this is now the place to go back. I mean, if you want to just write it separately, it depends how you're treating your notes. So, this is now Onan-Scott theorem. So, this was saying we have a group, it is primitive if and only if, in exactly one of the following cases. Okay, so we had case one was affine, case two was almost simple. Case three is what is called the diagonal type. And you find this theorem in these notes on computational group theory from me, which are on the webpage. This theorem is typed out in a nicer readable form. So if you feel this is really awkward to have different cases, you can find it there nicely written together. Okay. So what I had always was I had H, which is the socle of G, and there I had said it is isomorphic to M copies of T because I had G was a subgroup of Sn there. N was my degree. So, sorry, this is slightly different use of N in both cases. So what is happening in the diagonal type? In the diagonal type, I have that M is greater or equal than 2. Okay. Why does M have to be greater or equal than 2? Because otherwise my diagonal action would become the regular action. Okay. What can I tell about the degree? The degree is the order of t to the m minus 1. That's exactly the same as I had in the top right corner of the board, right? My point stabilizer has order of t, and the group has order of t to the m, so the degree must be order of t to the m minus 1. And that group is... Yeah, so that degree gets large pretty soon. The smallest degree where this can happen is degree 60. Because 60 is the order of the smallest simple non-abelian group. The next smallest simple non-abelian group has order 168. That is PSL, isomorphic to SL or PSL 27. That has order 168. And then I have M equals 2. If I take A5 and M equals 3, I have already degree 3,600. So this grows rather quickly. Okay, N has this. I know that G must be a subgroup of T wreath SM, which is just T to the M semi-direct product SM with outer automorphisms of T added, but these outer automorphisms act the same in every copy, right? That's the argument which I had done here. Okay. Okay. And this is something which is basically conditions for this diagonal action to be primitive. So far I've only done analysis. I've said if it is primitive, then
It must have this form. This is diagonal action. That's what the normalizer of the diagonal action. I have told you nothing about this group acting primitively. And that is a theorem which I'm not proving. So the following description is something which is non-trivial. It's not horribly hard, but I mean, all of these things where I'm saying it's not trivial but not horribly hard are between a page and a half in a, or between half a page and a half in a textbook. So they would take us probably at the speed I'm going between roughly around 1 clock hour to prove. And yeah, I don't think that's a good use of time. So we have two situations, and some people, some textbooks split these cases slightly differently. Namely, they basically, there is the case of degree 2 of m equals 2 and m greater or equal than 2. And that's what they're splitting. And then they do another, they say, oh, some other split in case 2. But I think it's actually more natural to do a slightly different split. Namely, so I'll give you case B first. Both fit in a row. I'll give you case B first because that's the case M is greater or equal than 2 and G acts primitively on T1 up to Tn. So the group will act on the direct factors of the circle by permutation. We always had this. And I could have an action, and if I could have an action where the action on the circle components is primitive, and that is enough to make this diagonal action also primitive. Okay. So, in some books, people say m greater or equal than 3 here. Because in case in degree 2, I don't necessarily need primitive action. So, I could have m is equal to 2 and g acts intransitively, right? Degree 2, if I'm not primitive, then I can't be transitive. The degree 2 there, that's the only options I have. Intransitively on t1 and t2.
Yes.
And that means both then are normal in g. Okay, and that is something one needs to show. This case might be a little bit surprising that this can happen. So if you take a diagonal action where you just have two copies, you don't need to swap the two copies to make this diagonal action primitive. So you could have this in degree 60 of A6 cross A6 in diagonal action. A5 cross A5 in diagonal action is primitive. And that's something one needs to show, and that holds actually general. Okay. And some split this off that they say m greater or equal than 3 and primitive, and m equals 2, and they don't say and either primitive or not primitive. I think this is a nicer split up, because what we see here in this case is this is a case where the circle of G is not minimally normal. Right? If I'm acting primitively on these copies of G, the circle must be minimally normal. So that gives rise to the circle not being minimally normal. Okay. And that is one of these situations. And again, the fact that either of these two things must hold basically is one needs to show these are sufficient conditions for making the group primitive, and also they are necessary conditions for making the group primitive. And these are, yeah, as I say, together it's probably about a page in the textbook. Okay. But these groups can, so that is class 3 of the Hohenheim-Scott theorem. And what we're going to do next time is then to
And now we can basically write down the remaining cases. Namely, these are primitive groups. They are also primitive. And we had seen if I take a primitive group and I take the wreath product and product action, I will get a primitive group. Right? So I can take a wreath product and product action where this is my first factor. And that's what will be case for A and B. And that's why this is C, because I want that for A and B will correspond exactly to these two cases. And case 4A and case 3A are the two situations where I have two minimal normal subgroups. Otherwise, the Sokal is always itself minimally normal. And what happens in these cases, and there I will not go further through the analysis, but here I had said in the here I had said I want that this kernel is trivial. If the kernel is not trivial, I can ask how many, well, if I intersect all of the kernels, I'm clearly trivial, because then I'm projecting trivial on every component. So I can ask what is a minimum set of kernels I can intersect to make that intersection trivial. And I can see that will actually give me a block structure for the action of G acting on these different copies in the socket. And what I will get, what this block structure will correspond to, is a direct product of diagonals, right? If I had four copies, I could glue the first and second together and the third and fourth together. And then I would have a direct product of two diagonals. And that's a mixed case, and that's a product action where my first factor is a diagonal, and that can also happen. Okay, but I already ran over more than what I should have. Thank you very much. Have a nice, I'm leaving later today for